We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Over the last 100 years or so, every time a new information technology has come along, we're talking here about things like telephone and radio, television, motion pictures, every time people have said that these things would usher in a new age of free expression. And every time, says our guest for this hour, media scholar Tim Wu, these new technologies became highly centralized, privately controlled industrial giants, driven mainly by commercial concerns. And one of the questions that he poses in his new book, The Master Switch, is, can we expect that this pattern will repeat when it comes to the internet and some of the big players in the IT business today? Tim Wu is author, policy advocate, also professor at Columbia University. He writes for Slate. He's also contributed to The New Yorker, Time, New York Times, Washington Post, and Forbes. His new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, is published by Knopf. It's out now if you'd like to read it. And as we talk here this morning, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that, 800-222-9455. You can also send along your questions by email to will-talk, that's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. Questions, comments are welcome. We hope people can be brief. That way we can get in as many people as possible. But, of course, your input is welcome. And Professor Wu, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Sure. Great. Good morning.
We appreciate it. You look in the book, as I said, you look at a little bit at the development of telephone, radio, television, motion pictures, and then go on to ask some questions about internet. And
yeah.
In each of these cases, you say you can trace the way that they have developed, and it is so predictable, each has followed the same cycle, that you in fact have identified something that you call the cycle, with a capital C, that would describe that. And maybe that would be the place to start. Talk a little bit about what that cycle is.
Sure. I think you've done a great job of summarizing the book, first of all, in the intro. And it's exactly as you've described. Typically, you have some new invention, and at the beginning, it's very unclear what it's going to be. Radio was invented, and people thought, well, this is good for ships. The telephone was invented. It was thought sort of a luxury service. You call your chauffeur or business conversations, film, they had this idea sort of for little short, amusing vaudeville-type clips. So there's some initial uncertainty about what this and it's, and usually you go from that initial period into what I call the sort of open or utopian period, which is one where suddenly people realize what this thing is going to be. It becomes a mass medium, popular, incredible period of entrepreneurism, And also, of great ideas as to what this thing could be. You know, it's going to connect people in a new way. It's going to open our culture up to something new. That period typically lasts for, I don't know, 10 to 20 years. And then eventually, through a variety of factors, which I can go to, you tend, as you described, to see the rise of a single, either a single monopolist or a cartel or a few companies in oligopoly, to kind of take this to a different level and a much more integrated, controlled, and ultimately commercial level. And you see this pattern repeat itself, as you've said, for many of these industries. And the question is, as you also said, is whether this will be the fate of the internet.
And you seem to be suggesting that, or it may be your feeling that we may, as far as the internet is concerned, we may be drawing to the close of the utopian period and moving into this next phase.
Yeah, maybe. The truth is I don't know the future. No one does. And I suggest some reasons it may be different this time around. There are a few reasons, and we may hear about them from our callers. I often have callers who question, say, that's impossible. It can never happen to the Internet. There are some differences in the Internet, but, yeah, basically, if history is any guide, it would suggest that we will, over the next, let's say, 5 or 10 years, see something we've already seen, which is the rise of several very large platforms who offer things that are very attractive to consumers. And this is the key, is it's not like they force this down people's throat. It's Hollywood came up with these beautiful films. I was very excited about them. NBC, when it got started, its promise to America was higher quality programming. And people thought, that's pretty great. And then and so forth. And, you know, they look at today, a company like Google or Apple or Facebook, you know, they're not offering us chopped liver, very attractive products, and then that tends to lead to a consolidation of the industry.
Well, that gets at, I think, what for a lot of people is a basic sort of issue, and that is when we talk about the potential effects of moving through this cycle to the point where we get to an industry that is maybe dominated by one or a couple of big players, that it becomes much more centralized, becomes much more closed.
Right.
Then people, I'm sure some people might say, well, you know, if I can get what I want, if there's someone who is willing to provide this service and it satisfies my needs, that the price is reasonable, so what? I mean, do I really care? Do I really care about Steve Jobs wanting to rule the world?
Right. It's kind of the same thing people say about democracy. Who cares if you get the vote as long as the government's good? You know, it's underlying it is the problem of free speech. The problem with these rising monopolies is they are often great at the beginning, as I suggested. They offer great services, Bell, AT&T, very reliable, good service. The problem is that they tend to stick around forever. They never leave. And at some point, even as they start in an attractive way, they tend to get increasingly abusive and at some level suppressive of innovation and speech because they don't want to be displaced. And so the problem we have, if we look at, you know, the problem isn't Apple or Facebook or Google right now. The problem would be them 40 years down the line when they're trying to make sure that nobody else gets involved in this Internet thing, or trying to, whatever the successor to the Internet might be, trying to make sure that thing never gets started. Those are the real problems.
Yeah, and I suppose the big concern here, and at some point I'm sure that we'll be talking about net neutrality, and I'm very interested in having you do a little update on where the FCC is with that. And this is something I know you've done a lot of writing and talking about. In fact, you're the guy who gets the credit for coining the term. So, but that goes to the idea of the master switch, and that is for people who are involved in these industries, it seems that the drive, sooner or later, the drive gets to be you want to have your hand on the master switch. And then the question is, well, is that a potentially dangerous or concerning thing if one person has their hand on the, you know, to use a different metaphor, if they've got their hand on the faucet and either they can turn it on or turn it off?
Well, I mean, of course it is in a country that was designed to resist centralized control. The whole idea of the revolution in the country is, you know, we don't trust kings, we don't trust autocrats, and even if the king says he's going to do a really good job, you know, we're going to mix it up a little bit. And I think I actually urge us in this book to take a more careful look at how we apply those same principles to private actors. The book concludes with this idea of the separations principle, which says, you know, we're very obsessed with separations of power in the public sector, but what about private sector? You know, why have we historically been tolerant of certain things being, especially speech industries, where speech is so important, you know, one or two actors being in charge of what gets heard. So, we don't have that right now. The Internet's been incredible for increasing the diversity of speech that you hear. Sometimes we might not like that in some ways, but you know, we think of something like WikiLeaks. Certain people haven't liked that. But no, I think it's much more consistent with the history of the United States that we try to resist centralized power.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Tim Wu. He's professor at Columbia University, and he is the author of a newly published book that's titled The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. It's published by Knopf, and he makes this argument that if you take a look at the way that information technologies have developed in the past, telephone, radio, motion pictures, television, they all follow very much the same sort of pattern that he has discussed. And as we have discussed, the big question here, one of the big questions is, well, what should we expect with the Internet as we go along here? Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly in the past, we have seen points where individual companies became dominant in certain kinds of industries, with transportation, with railroads, for example, with some kinds of heavy manufacturing, with automobile makers with big companies like General Motors. Is there something, though, that that IT companies, something about them that makes it more likely that that one or two players will become dominant?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there are special features of information that we call information economics that tend to make that tend to lead to monopolies in these areas. One is that are these all these companies tend to run on networks in one way or another, and whether it was the old TV stations, which were called networks, you know, like NBC, or of course the telephone network, and today the internet, which is in the network. And networks are strange. They get a little academic, but they, I'm sure you're a lot of academic listeners. What's strange about businesses based on networks is often whoever has the biggest network wins. So, you know, a company like Facebook, well, why do you use Facebook? It's because everyone else is on Facebook. It's pretty good software, too, but if no one was on it, you wouldn't use it. And so it's more popular. In the old days, AT&T had the same thing. The reason everyone used the AT&T phone system, and it was so hard to start a rival company, is, well, you know, who are you going to call on a network that's just you and someone else? So there is this tendency. There's a lot of, and, you know, a lot of this is described in the book. Another reason I might add is that there is something very tempting about holding that master switch that seems to attract a personality, the media mogul, who wants to get in there and be in charge. And that has certainly been a repeat pattern. We have colorful or power-seeking characters who aim to grab that golden ring, to change the metaphor.
We have a caller. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? Somebody on our toll-free line here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two things, actually. The first one, I don't think it's worth a damn, but anyway, we first started talking about communications and the ones that have, in a sense, increased their power. I thought immediately of telegraph.
Yes.
Then I thought of shortwave radio, which you, in a sense, talked about radio. Now, those two things, I was a shortwave enthusiast. Everything's now on satellite, and it's encrypted, and unless you want to get arrested, you can't mess with it. I was wondering about the laws and the FCC. Is it all these nasty fellows who want to expand their ego over the world, or are they in cahoots with other people, whether knowingly or unknowingly? Thank you.
Right,
those are fabulous questions. Let me talk about the first. First of all, telegraph is a big topic of the book. They were pretty interesting as the Western Union telegraph monopoly was sort of the first example of an unregulated monopoly. And they were interesting because when they had, using their power, they were involved in politics, trying to push elections one way or another using their power. So I think Western Union is one of the greatest examples. I don't talk in the book so much about shortwave radio, but I do talk about the long tradition of radio amateurism, which has this enormous influence on the United States, not very well understood. One of the things that's really interesting in this book is if you study these things often, so many of them start as amateur inventions, hobbies. In the radio space, the first radio stations are in the 1910s. Radio industry later tries to rewrite the history, but the truth is it all starts with basically, you know, young people, inventors who have these extremely rudimentary radio setups, very similar to shortwave to ham radio now, but then write any spectrum they want, and they just kind of chat with each other. It's kind of like the early internet or something. They kind of, and that out of that comes broadcast radio. Out of that comes eventually television. So the origins are incredibly interesting because they're always amateurs. The question is whether the FCC is involved. Yeah, they're usually, and I didn't mention this, but I out of time. But typically, the greatest aid to an aspiring monopolist is getting the help of the federal government, whether it was radio in the late 1920s, whether it was AT&T had the government help it by banning competition at all. And by about the 1950s, AT&T was so hard to displace that it was infeasible for the market to do anything. The FCC and the government had essentially guaranteed the monopoly. So the most important factor historically in the development of monopoly is gaining the aid and the assistance of the United States to prevent any kind of competition.
See, this, I think, is a very important and interesting point because I think we have the idea that the government essentially has an anti-monopolist stance, and in some cases that's true, but it also has favored particular companies, and so that it has this real mixed kind of stand when it comes to whether or not it's good for a company to dominate a particular industry.
Yeah, it's highly, highly inconsistent. The government, I guess generally because of the Sherman Act, thinks that competition is a good thing. But when in practice, you frequently see the government and different parts of it think differently in favor of monopoly or in favor of a very consolidated, controlled industry. In the 30s, the FCC, they wouldn't have said they liked monopoly. What they would have said is they wanted the industry to be organized and planned and sort of centrally controlled. They thought they were doing the best thing, but they felt that the way it would be handled the best was by a central planning agency. It's very similar, actually. You know, we think of ourselves as a free market country, but the FCC in the 30s, very similar to the Soviet Union in the 30s with their idea that everything has to be planned. We can't have the future just sort of happen. We have to figure it out. And so, for example, TV is invented in the late 20s, not really well known, but the FCC decides it's not really ready for prime time, to put it, use a metaphor, hadn't been invented. But TV is not quite ready for prime time yet, and they couldn't really sell it to consumers because it's not good enough. Now, can you imagine it today, someone saying, you know, the iPad's not there yet, we can't sell it to consumers. You know, we're going to wait another 15 years or so until we think the industry's got it figured out. But they were very involved in trying to decide what they thought, and by that they've certainly protected monopolies. In this telephone space, the government just basically, Congress agreed. They said, well, you know what, AT&T is great, monopoly's better, you can have your monopoly, fine. They just agreed. And so it's very inconsistent. And then, of course, much later, the antitrust department would break up the monopoly. But it's definitely, despite the fact that we have this idea we live in a free market country, which is generally true, occasionally the federal government has gone on gone out and said, no, we like monopoly better. They haven't always said that explicitly, but they've certainly made it happen. Hmm.
And it seems that now at this point where we are is that the government isn't really doing either. They're not quite so much favoring industries, and at the same time, they seem to be taking a rather hands-off attitude.
It's actually, well, generally speaking, with a few exceptions, and this may get a little techy, but one exception, for example, is in the world of cell phones, wireless phones, where obviously we use these devices every day. And without being open about it or explicit, the policies the federal government have set up, particularly the last 10 years, give Verizon and AT&T an enormous advantage over any other possible company. And if you noticed, most people, I mean, there's Sprint and T-Mobile still kind of hanging in there, but the two halves of the old Bell empire basically have, I don't want to say been explicitly granted, but have given an advantage in wireless that is becoming pretty insurmountable. And they are growing in market share. Everyone else is shrinking, those two parts of the AT&T empire. And it's through some pretty complex legislation that I don't want to get into, but essentially the control of the spectrum is quite limited, and the system favors them.
We have another caller to talk with here where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I guess I'm fascinated by the history, and I can recommend Eric Barnow and Herb Schiller and all these folks, but I'm kind of impatient about the FCC story because it looks like they're falling in line with the legislative intent that you just said, and the only thing we have is for the two, one of the two liberal members to join the Republican appointees in voting against what's coming from the Obama administration appointee for the head, because the consensus that I've been hearing from Save the Internet Movement, FreePress.net, is that no agreement is better than what's on the table, which will, again, give wireless over to the great conglomerates and undermine net neutrality and what's going to be probably the more important part of it when landlines are superseded. Can you respond to that? Or?
Sure. Yeah, no, I can. The caller is talking about net neutrality.
Yes. Yeah, sure. And let's go ahead and do that. Yeah.
Sure. The call. Thanks for the call, and it reveals an attention to what's going on in Washington. The caller's calling about net neutrality, and what he's describing is a frustration that I share, which is there is a net neutrality rule on the table right now, but it has a pretty big hole for the wireless industry. In fact, it's... The way it's written, it suggests that the wireless internet can be treated very differently than the regular internet. So, for example, you could buy a Verizon phone or an AT&T phone, an AT&T phone in theory could block Google altogether, just give you no access to Google anything. And a Verizon phone, for example, could retaliate and offer you nothing that Microsoft offers or Yahoo or something else and try and sell you on their particular thing. So it seems to make legal the old good old walled garden approach, which is something the Internet just really hasn't been about. And so there is a fight on in Washington right now over the next couple of weeks. And what's happening politically is the chairman has proposed these rules with this big exception, which is because AT&T, AT&T and Verizon insist on a big exception for wireless. This is their future. And the FCC is traditionally very responsive to industry. And you have two commissioners, but particularly Commissioner Copps, who's been in it for a while and says, you know, we're not going to let this happen. And so he's in negotiations, and we're going to see what happens. He's putting a lot of pressure on the chairman, Julius Jernikowski, to try to change this rule. So it's, you know, one of these West Wing dramas at the moment, a very interesting thing going on. The final vote will come on December 21st, and there'll be a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff between now and then.
It's kind of ironic in a way that, I mean, there was pressure at the beginning, and there was some expectation that the FCC would just reverse the Bush administration's FCC's ruling about abandoning common carrier and that kind of thing. And but apparently that's not seen as reasonable. But what I'm also there seems to be an irony here is that if we're talking about the public airwaves, the wireless space. You know, obviously now they're talking about how unlimited it is, but it isn't unlimited, and that makes it even more of a public resource than the arguments that can be made about wired space, common carrier, however, does impinge on that. Can you sort that out a little?
I agree with you about what you said. I think that. One thing that was, you know, the Obama administration came to power and had a lot of promises, and a lot of them related to tech and policy and tech policy, in particular, trying to reverse some of the Bush administration. And for some reason, they just didn't really act. They did have a disfavorable ruling from the D.C. Circuit, but there was an easy way around it, and they just have been too hesitant. Do so, and to be honest, the reason is that there. Once you get into Washington, you come under incredible pressure from the regulated companies, particularly AT&T and Verizon, who are extremely effective in ways that don't really make sense out of Washington. But when you're in there, it makes sense. Incredibly effective at putting pressure on people, and they've done that, and they've slowed down and sandbagged the Obama administration's FCC. So that the rule they're proposing is, first of all, on a very weak jurisdictional basis, it's likely to get struck down by the courts. They didn't go back to their old authority, which they were given to regulate AT&T in 1934. They decided not to take the path where they have the most power because the pressure was intense. And the way they apply pressure is interesting. I mean, it's not just people coming into the office, so that's part of it. They also get congressmen to write letters or threaten to pull people into hearings or make their life miserable or defund them. So there's all these ways in which the phone companies, which routinely talk about controlling X number of congressmen, will behind closed doors will say, we have 60 congressmen who will harass you unless you abandon this approach, have been effective at slowing down. So, yes, it's a lot. What's coming out of the Obama administration is a lot weaker than you would have thought based on what people were saying going in. And I forgot the second question.
Well, here, let me. I want to jump in here because we're already at our midpoint. I have
sure.
some other callers.
Yeah.
What I'd like to do with this, though, because you know, we've talked about this on the program before, and I think at some point I always feel that there would be people would be very confused about this,
sure.
and would be wondering, well, what does that really have to do with me?
Sure. Well, let me make that clear.
Yeah.
You know, this is all about your cell phone. So a lot of people use smartphones every day. I don't know about you, but. A part of it has to do with whether they put any effective control on pricing, which they've been completely afraid of. To have any, my bill is crazy. I don't know about you, but you know, whether there's any control at all over pricing, which is something the carriers are fighting incredibly strong. And second of all, it determines what kind of choices you'll have on the smartphone platform, whether it will be the internet you reach on your smartphone will be the Internet or whether it will be sort of a modified, selected version of the Internet. And I think that's an important question for free speech purposes. You know, these smartphones, they used to be these little gadgets, but they're becoming what we use these days to do everything. And the question, you know, can you go to YouTube? Is it the Internet or not, which I think is a fundamentally important question.
Yeah, and I think here the terms of the discussion here have maybe shifted a little bit. At one point when we were talking about net neutrality, I think there the basic idea was, does the government have the authority, should it regulate Internet service providers to make sure that they are completely open and they're not either blocking some people or favoring others? And now, though, when we're getting so much to wireless devices like smartphones, it seems like the ISPs have sort of ceded the ground of wired connections. They've said, "Okay, FCC, you want to regulate that? We got no problem with that." But what they don't want is the regulation of the wireless, because they know that's where things are going. And the question now, the basic question seems to be, well, what is the FCC going to decide should be the boundaries of its authority, and is it going to be minimal or is it going to be maximal? And that seems to be what the fight is over.
Right. I think your understanding of the situations is excellent and right. I'll quote an AT&T lobbyist in a secret negotiation recently. He said, you know, the problem with wireless is any water in the basement, any kind of FCC authority at all, and eventually will become completely controlled, they think. You know, and I'm not I don't think they should be as regulated as heavily as they were. As I said, I think heavy regulation is dangerous. But I think you need some consumer protection in wireless. You know, I don't know. That's just the most fundamental. And I think, as you pointed out, the spectrum is owned by the public. So it's strange. Well, we have the stuff that we own, you know, it's like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite Valley or something. And then we have someone who's charging his crazy fees and wants to, like, sort of limit who gets to come and what's going on there. And somehow we think that they have a right to do that. It's sort of all backwards.
Hmm. And we think that then maybe in about a week, after an awful lot of debate and the discussion, we'll see how at least something is going to happen here with the FCC?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. They proposed a rule. They're going to vote on the 21st. I'm watching. You're not allowed to lobby them after today, actually. So there'll be a last-minute flurry of meetings and people running around. And then they're locked in their rooms until the 21st, and then we'll see what comes out of it. So I advise listeners to, actually, if they want to, they should get on the phone with the chairman of the FCC and leave a message and say, you know, do the right thing. That's my opinion. Yeah.
All right, we have a couple of callers here, and let me just very quickly introduce again our guest as we're at our midpoint. Tim Wu, he is author, policy advocate, professor at Columbia University. He writes for Slate, has contributed to other publications, New Yorker Time, New York Times, Washington Post, Forbes. He is a fellow of the New America Foundation, chairman of the media reform organization Free Press, and has a new book out that looks at the history of telecommunications development in the United States, and maybe not just telecommunications, because we're talking about telephone, but we're also talking about radio and TV and motion pictures and what's likely to happen with the Internet. He argues that they all follow very much the same pattern, and you can read about it in his book, The Master Switch. It's published by Knopf. We have some callers ready to go here, so I'll go next to Atlanta, Illinois, and line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've thought about this subject for a long time, and years ago I read in a book that the Internet would be one of the great centralizing tools of all time, and that promoted me to compare that to the other media things. But the one media thing that never fell into the trap, as I can see it, I was never involved in it, but CB radio seemed to completely remain private for obvious reasons. And I was kind of hoping along the way that the Internet would kind of fall into that type of a situation, however, knowing that it was going to be so attractive in other media events that it wouldn't. But that was always my hope. And that's pretty interesting about CB radio being able to be, you know, in individual hands, and it still is today. So I'm going to get off and see what you think about that question. Thank you.
All right.
Now, that's a great question, and the caller has probably thought about these things before I have. CB radio is a fascinating question. It is part of the old tradition of unlicensed and or amateur usage, and I do think there's a chance the internet can keep some of that character. Obviously, it's extremely commercial, unlike CB. I grew up a little bit with CB radio myself, although I was just a kid, and I thought it was the most amazing thing. I don't know why it's not used more often. You're sitting there on the highway and you're bored, and you know, you talk to other people around you. It just seems like, wow, that just makes so much sense. I had this great kind of feeling to it. I shouldn't say in the past tense. It's not as popular as it used to be, obviously, but it's still around. But I think that's sort of, when you think about what, at some level, our public media is for, it's just so we can talk to each other. And the internet has been great for that in some ways. I mean, you if you use Twitter or YouTube, or Wikipedia, you just sort of see what people are doing. And I love that spirit. And there is some strength to it. I, as I said, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that the internet is going to become, you know, like the couch potato centralizing influence forever. There is a lot of amateur work on the internet, and it's strong. It's just that historically these forces have lost out when there's a lot of money at stake.
It seems that with increased availability of mobile communications, that really eclipses by giving people the same tool that they're already used to using,
right.
that the ability to essentially do the same thing. Why would you need the CB when you can use your cell phone essentially for the same thing?
Yeah, although the CB, you know, that's what's so interesting. The CB was so the design of the CB radio was really ingenious, and I should say still is ingenious. In fact, you just have agreed upon channels, and anyone in a certain range can talk to each other. Mm. You know, we have that. You could call someone theoretically who you drove by, but we don't know each other's phone numbers, and we're sort of locked into our big cars. No, it doesn't quite have the same design. CB radio was a stroke of genius.
All right. Well, I will talk again with another caller, and this is someone in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning, gentlemen. I got to preface this by telling you that I'm talking to you on a rotary dial phone.
All right. Me too, by the way.
Okay. Oh, good. I'm glad we're keeping it alive.
AT&T Model 500 myself.
Oh, well, mine's just a black one.
Yeah, that's probably the Model 500. So I studied these phones pretty carefully at some point in my...
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
I might be leading slightly off the track here, Mr. Angel. I hope I'm not. It seems, that our public is controlled by media a great deal, and that means our policies and our politics and everything else are all controlled by media a lot, and these media waves are owned by us. But yet, in America, the elections are formulated by very expensive media expenses to get the right person in. So in other words, the people who have the money are able to become politicians who control the very thing that you're talking about. But in Europe, every place else, Asia, Europe, South America, Canada, Mexico, they control their waves in a different way, and it's not so expensive to get politicians in who regulate these things. So it seems as though the media has become owned by certain people to control the media. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I'll talk about that. There's a number of issues going in there together. Now, first of all, I'll say that the book is not specifically about the news and the control of news media. And there's no real good reason for that other than you can only write one book, and covering everything was a challenge. I have a few feelings about that. First of all, I do feel very strongly that America does own the airwaves, and it's a public trust, and that it should be treated that way, and we should continue to think of it that way. I'm not the European approach to things I have mixed feelings about. It's hard to generalize, but there tends to be much more, even more government guarantee of monopoly traditionally in things like, and often just the government would run it itself. And I am not always so fond of that approach because it has a similar stagnating powers. However, what you're really talking about is campaign funding, I believe, or the use or the idea that perhaps, for example, you should just give every candidate who wants free airtime to speak to the people. And I think there's some logic to that. I don't get into that too much in the book. But, you know, given the fact that you have these public resources, the idea that they would be used for public elections makes some sense as opposed to going to the highest bidder, given the sort of concerns we have here. But, I don't – those are topics a little bit beyond my my competence.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I do want to get another point that the caller did touch on a little bit,
sure.
And something that I think is really interesting, and that is if you look at the way that these technologies have developed – things like this, going back to the telegraph, you know, telegraph, telephone,
yep.
Radio, television, the way they developed in the United States and the way they've developed almost everywhere else, and how it is that governments in other countries have looked at them and how the government in this country has looked at them, two very different patterns. And maybe the big difference is that here in the United States, the government said, well, private business, you take it and run with it, and if you can make money at it, great. And at other places, the government seemed to think, no, this is something that we really need to keep a hold of.
Right.
Why was it that we see this very basic difference between the United States and almost every place else?
Yeah, it's a fascinating historic question. I just think there is, from the beginning, I guess it would have been there was a period where the United States was interested also in nationalizing things, and there was a brief period where the United States government owned the entire phone system. But there was a sense, and so there was a turning point here where we could have gone the same way as Europe and had everything owned by the government. But there was a sense, and it's hard to explain what happened. The government just didn't do a very good job of running the phone service, and historically the unions. This is actually based on a different. Let me just tell you about the unions. The unions opposed government ownership because they found the government difficult to strike against, and so they're just almost by historical coincidence, the left became quite opposed to government ownership in this country, particularly labor. And so the phone company was returned to AT&T, and since then we've basically had the system of having a regulated monopoly. Or since that point, you had the government in partnership with private companies. So it's a very, you know, there's no grand reason. I think you just have to look at the history and say, well, that's why that happened. Although typically, as I said, it's the companies that have run media have never been completely public. They're often in a close relationship with government and take advantage of something like government spectrum or a guarantee against monopoly. So anyway, it's a fascinating history and a fascinating question, and I think the answer is just very specific. And maybe just that old sense that Americans have always somewhat favored smaller government in every area except for military.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, and again, our guest is Tim Wu, a professor at Columbia University. The book we're talking about is titled The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. It's just recently out from Knopf. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. There's one company that really is at the center of the book, and that is AT&T.
Yeah.
When you look at this pattern where, as we talked about at the beginning, the cycle, you know, where you start with you have a new invention, and then there's a great period of excitement, and you have entrepreneurs, and people are jockeying for position, and they're trying to see what they can do to improve it. People get very excited about it. They think, oh, this thing's going to change the world. But then what happens is there is generally the rise of one person, and as you say, media seems to lend itself to this, some mogul, some person or company that takes over. Then you get into this consolidation, centralization. The thing before that had been very open, where all kinds of people were in there and competing, then becomes closed, and it can stay that way for a long time. And maybe the key sort of example is indeed AT&T. And when you talk about your media moguls, you write about a man named Theodore Vail, who was the founder of the Bell System, who was, maybe now people would think of Rupert Murdoch, but, you know, Theodore Vail was Rupert Murdoch before. Rupert Murdoch, and he's somebody that though at the same time, probably nobody unless you're a media scholar have heard of.
Right, and he's a fascinating character. One of the things that's so interesting about him, and he talks, I have his speeches, many of them in the book, is he has a very different vision of capitalism than what we consider our vision now, because he just says, listen, monopoly is better. Let's just face it. Having multiple companies fighting with each other is wasteful. He said, and also immoral, that all this competition that leads people to try and undercut each other and do underhanded tactics. No, forget it. What you need to do, what we need in America is just one big company per industry that is run by good, responsible men and does the best for the public, and that's what we need. And he said, that's what I'm going to do with AT&T. You'll see. We'll be a monopoly, but we'll be a good monopoly. And since that time, I think we've always struggled with this question in America. Part of what he says, I think, is right, that there are advantages to big companies for certain things. They're reliable, they're dependable, and so forth. But he offered this sort of promise of a friendly giant. Mm-hmm. You know, we're incredibly powerful, but we will be good. And I think we still struggle with that. A company like Google today, which we all rely on to find things, I think we have this question, well, they're big, but can we trust them is always the underlying question. And they also, similar to AT&T, Google in our time has promised, we will be good. We will not do evil or be evil.
And so, and not just Google, but a lot of the big names now, I think they're trying to make the same argument that yes, they're, you know, whether we're talking about Apple or Microsoft or Google or or whatever, that they are the benevolent giant. You know, watch where you stand, because if they step on you, you're in big trouble. But on the other hand, they say, but really, we're not trying to step on people. We're just trying to make your life better.
Right, exactly. They say, you know, if let's say Microsoft in the old day would, you know, someone was making something, an alarm clock, and then they incorporated the operating system, and they said, this has improved the product. And it incidentally pushes out the competition, but it improves the product. So we have a tradition in America of monopolists who pledge themselves to serve the public. And it's a fascinating dynamic, one which I think we really need to ask in the coming years, whether we're happy with that. And if not, what can we do about it? It's not an easy question, because in some ways, I don't want to say they're completely inevitable, but so long as Americans continue to sort of follow the leader, you know, go with the best product, we will create monopolists. I mean, it's us. I use Google. I think most of your listeners are probably going to use Google today at some point, and they do it because it's good. And so, but when we all use something because it's good, we create monopolies, and then we have to start asking these questions: is can we trust them and with all their power, and what are we going to do about that? And it's a repeat question. AT&T posed it in its most original and obvious forms, where AT&T just got out there and said, we're a monopolist, and that's the best. But I want to suggest we have the exact same question today.
Yeah. We have someone here on cell phone in Champaign. Let's go there, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I thoroughly enjoy your show, and I know we're coming to a close. I'll be brief. Related to the just a couple of comments, related to the Citizens Band Radio, actually, it was originally licensed free. I think there was a small fee, then they went free. I still have my original 1960s or 70s, I still have my original government-issued CB license.
Well, that's great.
The second is, when you talk about the, I would call them, life changes within the technology of IT, intellectual, or communications devices, there is a fundamental difference between the telephone, telegraph, actually television, and radio. All of those, if I'm not mistaken, going back to Bell, Edison, and so forth, all of those were patented, U.S. Patent Office, by private individuals. The government did not own a single piece of that technology. Edison formed his own light companies, Alexander Graham Bell, so forth and so on. The Internet, on the other hand, although I won't get into the Al Gore argument, however, the Defense Applied Research DARPA did provide the original seed money to the university to what essentially all they did was link to prove that they could link multiple computer systems together to communicate first within a lab, then a building, and so forth. So the government essentially did have a piece of that technology, even though I don't think there was ever any patents issued.
Right.
So that was the fundamental difference. All of the major developments within the early days was all patented by private individuals. Government couldn't touch it. Mm-hmm. They would have had to buy the rights or so forth. Okay, I'll shut up.
Okay, well, thanks for the comments.
It's a great comment. It's, you know, it is one of the things that I write about my book. My book is the story of the founding of all these industries and kind of takes you back to that moment when, for example, the Bell was a three-person startup. I mean, it's hard to imagine a company like AT&T is a startup, but, you know, in their time, there were just three people, and as the caller said, with one patent. There is a difference in the birth of the Internet and the other technologies, and it's exactly as the caller described. The Internet was a public project, and a rather weak one. At the beginning, at least, you know, years before it got anywhere beyond the laboratory, it was sort of a academic project. The fact that this is a popular mass project is a fascinating development. In fact, you know, it's as if something NASA built would start being used by everybody. So I do think that does make a difference, and I think it's one of the things that has made the Internet different and made it somewhat more resistant to control. Some of the big companies that we're talking about, like Google, or actually like FM radio, interestingly, also had their start in academia. Google started the computer science department at Stanford. FM radio at the beginning was at Columbia. And so there's sometimes things that are not quite government-funded but are academic in their origins as well, and that, I think, often also makes them just a little bit different. The point, I think, is that origins matter. The beginning story, the early instincts last for a very, very long time, and that's kind of the point of the master switch.
We are coming down to a couple of minutes there. There's one key idea here I want to make sure I give you the chance to talk a little bit about, and that's the separations principle. Your suggestion that one thing that could be done, that should be done, would be to separate the content producers from the content to separate the people who produce content and programs and so forth from the people who have the pipe. From which it flows.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, when I looked back at the last 150 years, basically from telegram to internet, the greatest sources of abuse and problems tend to come from when there's too much vertical integration. That is to say, someone owning the pipes, the movement of information, like you said, and someone also the same person controlling the creation of information, that leads to the greatest conflicts of interest. One person owning too many vertical layers, whatever those vertical layers may be, tends to create problems. And the problem is the fad right now is more of that going on. Comcast is trying to get a hold of NBC, and it looks like unless the government does something, puts an extreme, tries to stop, it doesn't look like the government's going to stop it, so that looks like it's going to happen. And I think it creates enormous, and just a natural conflict of interest, because if you're trusting someone to bring you information and then they also own the information, they're always going to want to bring you their information. And so I think it's best to be avoided, and that is what I end the book with, and saying, looking back over this long period, watch out for this problem.
Yeah, and that gets us back again for those people whose head still spins over the conversation about net neutrality. That gets us back to the question of why that matters.
Yeah.
If you have business interests with some kind of content, whether that's your company or whether they're just a buddy of yours, the idea is that what people are saying is the government should say, now look, you can't block access to your competitors. And you can't bump your own content or the content of people that you have good relations with up to the top of the list. It's supposed to essentially be, you know, when someone, if they're going to use Google, when they go searching for something, they ought to be able to get to whatever they want.
Right. I think that's right. I mean, it's not just like some techie principle. This is about free speech. This is about speech. I mean, and that's fundamental to the republic, is what can you get access to? And I think a lot of the callers have been talking about things like citizens band radio, and, you know, they may seem like these kind of hobbies, but they are about what kind of speech environment we have in America. And I think it's something we always have to pay attention to.
And you talked a little bit about the potential Comcast NBC deal. That may be one. Are there others, potentials for putting together a company that could be as dominant as AT&T once was?
Sure. I mean, you just connect the dots. The Comcast NBC thing, these things tend to become, businesses are like fashion. They get these trends go on. And the AOL Time merger people remember the AOL Time Warner merger. That was such a failure because, for reasons I explain in the book, that vertical integration became unpopular for a while. But with Comcast, NBC, you can sort of see a comeback. And I don't know, you connect the dots. Maybe Apple and AT&T get together. You know, what does that look like? It's just, it's fascinating to contemplate what might happen. Verizon or Google become very, very close, for example. It's fascinating to imagine what kind of things could happen in the future.
And your feeling is that the chances are that the government, if they're going to take the kind of approach that they have in the past, that largely they'll just stand back from that?
Well, they haven't shown any real signs of wanting to get involved. I think they may put some conditions. That's kind of the way they do things. But I think largely, it's not a done deal. I think what the government should do is, what they will do and should do are different questions. I think they should be very suspicious of giant vertical mergers and keep the eye out. And NBC Comcast is relatively small compared to what could happen. So I can sort of understand. I think they should stop it, but if they let that pass, they should sort of draw the line in the sand and say nothing bigger than that.
Yeah. And just this question just comes to me now, and we have about a minute or so.
Sure.
In terms of what's next, where things go next with communications technology, it seems pretty clear that what we're doing is moving in a direction where more and more people are going to get more and more of their media through the Internet and probably through increasingly smaller wireless devices.
Right.
And until they get to when they can beam it right into our heads, is that what we're going to be looking at here for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think the wireless devices might be getting bigger as opposed to smaller, but like the iPad.
Quite so.
But there's another layer of stuff going on other than just the gadgets, which is the rise of the platform versus the Internet. So the real question in the future is whether are you really using the Internet or is Facebook your experience or the iPhone your experience or is Android what your experience is? It's a slightly different thing. You know, for a long time, the web, and then we've been sort of thinking the Internet is the platform and people start a company. The move and the really big question is whether we move to something where it is the company that matters more than the Internet.
Mm.
You know, whether you go to Google for your stuff or, you know, And just watch your own behavior, and then you'll see whether it is the Internet now or whether it is a series of private platforms.
Tim Wu is our guest. His book is The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires, published by Knopf. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's been great. It's a pleasure.